Vice Chancellor of the University, Professor Makanya, the President of Cabo Verde, maybe let me say former President, President Pedro Pires, President Mbeki, the patron of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation. They are about to come in and will commence. So if we can settle down our cell phones, if we can't switch them off, let's put them on silent. Deputy Chairperson of Council, welcome. Mrs. Makanya, Professor Chabani Manganye, Deputy Chair of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, President Pires, President Mbeki, Vice Chancellor Makanya, Indira Pires, today we continue with the celebration of Africa Day, marking the 50 years of the Organization of African Unity. President Thabo Mbeki, patron of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, President Pedro Pires, our honored guest who will deliver our lecture today, Dr. Mokoni Matabane, Deputy Chair of the University of South Africa, Principal and Vice Chancellor Professor Mandla Makanya and Mrs. Makanya, Indira Pires, the daughter of President Pires, you're welcome, sister. The Thabo Foundation trustees present here and management, Dr. Zacharias, head of the UNDP, members of the diplomatic corps all present, head of Timali, our fraternal organization, UNISA management, students, South Africans, you are all welcome to this celebration. I would ask Professor Mandla Makanya to come and welcome us as our host in this university.
Thank you very much, Program Director. Mrs. Togo Didiza. Just want to say that, by the way, our poet, who is none other than Dr. Don Matera, is in fact holding an honorary doctorate with the University of South Africa. Dr. Thabo Mbeki, former President of the Republic of South Africa, His Excellency Mr. Pedro Pires, former President of the Republic of Cape Verde, Dr. Mokoni Matabane, the Deputy Chairperson of our Council, Mrs. Makanya there, members of the diplomatic corps present, Professor Chabani Manganyi, the Deputy Chairperson of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, and other members of the Thabo Mbeki board present here, Mr. Thabang Makwetla, Deputy Minister of Defense and Military Veterans, Ms. Rejoice Mobutafasi, Deputy Minister of Water and Environmental Affairs, and other members of national and provincial government present, friends of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation present, former cabinet ministers, Dr. Zacharias Augustino, United Nations Resident Coordinator and UNDP Resident Representative, members of the ecclesiastical community present, among them our Bishop Josie Walker and Mrs. Walker, members of the executive and extended management of UNISA, and members of other educational institutions who are also with here tonight, our distinguished domestic and foreign guests, friends of UNISA, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. As Principal and Vice-Chancellor of the University of South Africa, it is my signal honor and pleasure to welcome you to the annual Thabo Mbeki Africa Day Lecture. At the inaugural annual Thabo Mbeki Lecture at the University of South Africa on 27 May 2010, patron of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, His Excellency Mr. Thabo Mbeki addressed the provocative question posed by the World Bank in 2000. Can Africa claim the 21st century? He proposed six practical steps that Africa must undertake if it is to claim the 21st century, asserting that the first step will be to build and nurture the native intellectual cadre committed to the transformation of Africa, as envisaged by leading African patriots and thinkers in a period spanning some 150 years. He said, quote, "An urgent task in this regard is to rebuild and sustain our universities and other centers of learning, attract back to Africa intellectuals who have migrated to the developed north, build strong links with the intelligentsia in the African diaspora, and give them the time and space they need to help determine the future of Africa," unquote. And at the official launch of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation and the Thabo Mbeki Africa Leadership Institute, during an international conference themed Investing in Thought Leaders for Africa's Renewal, held in Johannesburg from 11 to 13 October 2010, the retired Principal and Vice-Chancellor of UNISA, Professor Nyameko Banipijana, in addressing the imperative for the marshalling of Africa's intellectual forces towards the betterment of our continent, stated the following, quote, "The partnership and collaboration between the Thabo Mbeki Foundation and the University of South Africa in the establishment of the Thabo Mbeki African Leadership Institute should marshal these intellectual forces and critical voices to Africa's betterment. This international conference should set the agenda that will draw Africa's intellectual resources, stimulate young Africans to become achievers, bristling with new ideas, and set the tone for the new positive inclination for Africa that honors its past, engages the present, and shapes the future," unquote. Tonight, as we continue on our mutual journey to claim the 21st century, we will engage the present and shape the future as we tackle the very complex notion of defining Africa's place in the 21st century. And as we do that, we will do so in the knowledge that this evening is but one important milestone in a year of milestones for our continent and for UNISA. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Organization of African Unity, now the African Union. As we know, the Organization of African Unity was established on 25 May 1963 in Addis Ababa upon the signing of the OAU Charter by representatives of 32 governments. A further 21 states have joined gradually over the years, with South Africa becoming the 53rd member on 23 May 1994. The theme of this year's 50th anniversary celebrations is Pan-Africanism and African Renaissance. According to the chairperson of the African Union Commission, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, the continent has made great strides in the last 50 years and needs now to look to the future. Reflecting on those who have contributed to this milestone, she said, quote, "As we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the OAU and AU, we are inspired by their example and pledge to work together in solidarity for an integrated, people-centered, and prosperous Africa at peace with itself," unquote. Closer to home, 2013 marks the University of South Africa's 140th birthday, and we have undertaken to spend the year paying tribute to the wonderful people, achievements, activities, and initiatives at UNISA, and how these have contributed to our understanding and articulation of what it means to be an African in the 21st century. The theme for our 140-year celebration is celebrating 140 years of shaping futures. I believe that this evening's lecture brings together these remarkable milestones, themes, and celebrations in the most fitting manner as we define Africa's place in the 21st century and contemplate the role that each one of us has to play in building on the legacy of those who have gone before us and bringing to fruition the aspirations of African leaders and the peoples of Africa for Africa. And so we at UNISA continue to affirm our vision and aspiration to be the Africa University in the service of humanity. We assert our identity as a university that is located and rooted in an African context, developing knowledge, skills, attitudes, and values necessary for the development of the continent, where critical scholarship from an African perspective becomes an authentic part of the global knowledge enterprise. As a key stakeholder, not only in knowledge production through teaching, learning, research, and community engagement, but also in the creation of intellectuals and future leaders, UNISA aims to ensure that it facilitates thinking in Africa on Africa by African scholars so as to generate an authentically African voice that will be acknowledged and respected universally. UNISA believes that as Africans, we need to be confident about claiming our space and ascendancy in a global environment that is undergoing a fundamental reorientation, and we aim to make an ongoing and growing contribution to the generation of truly African knowledge to this country and this continent's intelligentsia, to our thought leaders and to our leadership, and to our socio-economic development. We are proud and excited to be making that contribution. Equally, there can be no doubt that the Thabo Mbeki Foundation is fulfilling its vision to be a catalyst for the achievement of an African Renaissance by mobilizing Africa's progressive forces and creating a platform for dialogue to promote the birth of a continental social movement driven by a new cadre of leaders dedicated to Africa's political, social, and economic development. That platform for dialogue speaks directly to the dire need across Africa for intellectual engagement on African leadership and an African articulation and interpretation of its growth trajectory. I especially would like to express my gratitude to the patron of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, the former president, Mr. Thabo Mbeki, and the board members of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation for the very influential role that they have played in inviting our guest of honor tonight, His Excellency Mr. Pedro Verona Rodriguez Pires, the former president of Cape Verde. Your Excellency, you are most welcome. I wish also to thank and welcome all leaders from the local, provincial, and national government, members of the diplomatic corps present tonight, as well as leaders of universities and research institutes, leaders of various formations, including political parties and community organizations, leaders from the business sector, and members of the media, UNISA students and student leaders, as well as our staff and members of society who are present tonight. We are delighted that you have honored us with your presence tonight. In conclusion, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce to you the patron of the Thabo Mbeki African Leadership Institute, former President of the Republic of South Africa, His Excellency Thabo Mbeki. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I could go on and on listing the accolades of the men who immortalized the proud claim, "I am an African." But I would like to share with you the delightfully personal summary provided by the former governor of the Reserve Bank, Mr. Tito Mboweni, in his speech entitled "Reflections on the Life and Times of President Thabo Mvuyelwa Mbeki," from a lecture delivered at the ANC branch meetings at the University of Johannesburg and at Helderfontein Conference Center, Johannesburg, November 23 and 24, 2012, respectively. Mr. Mboweni summed it up so beautifully when he said, quote, "And so from the mission schools emerged a whole crop of early African intellectuals who could not countenance exclusion from normal participation in the affairs of state, or their being made second or third class citizens in their own country. They fought with all means at their disposal. They wrote, petitioned, protested, started newspapers, Ilangalase Natali, Imvuza Bansundu, and many others, preached equality in their churches, joined forces with chiefs and commoners, and linked up with like-minded people in the United States of America and the United Kingdom, and founded all types of organizations towards the end of equality and justice. They fought hard for our freedoms. These characteristics of our forebears have found concrete expression in President Mbeki, a thinker, a writer, an organizer, political leader, a campaigner, and above all, someone who is committed to the freedom and advancement of his people in South Africa, in Africa, and in the African diaspora, and amongst all who are exploited and excluded by the global forces of power and money," unquote. Your Excellency, patron of the Thabo Mbeki African Leadership Institute, I now call upon you to come to the podium to welcome our guest lecturer this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Makanya. And President Pedro Pires, and friends. You will see, according to this program, which I think everybody has got, it says here, I must introduce the president. But having said that, it then includes a very good biography of the president here. So I think the introduction has been made in this program. A few months ago, I phoned the president, President Pires, and said to him, could he please come this year to deliver this Africa Day lecture? And I'm very, very glad indeed that he immediately, very promptly, without any hesitation, agreed. I was very, very glad about that because we had discussed this matter as to whom we should invite this year. Pedro Pires was here last year. People who might have come last year will remember that he sat on a panel with President Obasanjo and President Chissano and myself to celebrate Africa Day then. But he has come back this day this time as our lecturer. I'm saying that we discuss this matter as to whom we should invite. Because exactly of what has been mentioned by our program director, by what Professor Makanya has just said, that this is the 50th anniversary of the OAU. And therefore, a special year for the continent, and indeed the reason we're meeting today here on the 31st of May rather than the 25th of May, is because we had to respect a very big that took place at the OAU headquarters in Addis Ababa on the 25th of May. So we agreed that we would postpone our own celebration here out of respect for that process at the AU. In the course of our discussion as a foundation to say who is going to be our lecturer today, indeed in the end we all agreed that we should ask President Pedro Pires to deliver the lecture this year. Because indeed the occasion of this 50th anniversary of the OAU is indeed an opportunity to discuss Africa yesterday, Africa today, Africa tomorrow, to reflect on all of these challenges in order to say where do we go from here. And indeed we decided on President Pires because we believed that he was eminently qualified to address all of these questions. And that indeed you could not have a better lecturer on this occasion of the 50th anniversary of the OAU than himself. I'm saying eminently qualified because President Pires bridges a whole period of time on our continent. We have with us here an outstanding liberation fighter, person who, when you say, let's go into the bushes, into the jungle, take up gun and fight, knows exactly what that means. because he was a member of the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, together with the late Amilcar Cabral. These are the people who fought to end Portuguese colonialism on our continent. And so, President, some people from the state side, government side, will say, Your Excellency, but from the rest of us, we'll say, Comrade. And President Pires did all sorts of other things on our continent. Indeed, even if we look at the ending of the war in Angola, which resulted in the withdrawal of the South African Defense Force from there, which led to the independence of Namibia. Again, we'll turn to President Pedro Pires to say thank you very much for his contribution towards that. You are therefore also dealing here with a statesman, Prime Minister and President of Cape Verde, who during the time that he was in government did many things, including achieving important socioeconomic development in Cape Verde, including entrenching the process of democracy on the sister African country. So we're saying because of all of these experiences, which stress from then the days of the liberation struggle to liberate our continent to the rebuilding of the continent, we don't think of anybody better qualified than President Pedro Pires, Comrade Pires, to deliver this year's Africa lecture. So that's the introduction of the President. President, thank you very much for coming. Welcome. Please, President, come and take over here. Thanks.
mentioned it, actually. At the outset, allow me to thank my friend, President Mbeki, for his kind invitation. I would also like to thank all of you for your presence and interest here tonight. I must confess that I never imagined that I would take on the role of speaker at conferences, as has been the case so often lately since leaving active political life. I have no intention to present an elaborate historical study this evening. Rather, I would like to present you with some of my memories and reflections which I have gathered over my years as freedom fighter and later as politician or political leader. Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, and dear friends, I thought that at this time it would have been remiss of me to ignore the 50th anniversary celebrations of the Organization of African Unity. Therefore, I will start precisely there. Indeed, the African Union has just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Organization of African Union, an initiative that I welcome with great hope. I am well aware of the fact that these celebrations have been accompanied by a strong desire to revive the ideal of Africa as a single entity, the desire to value the precursors of Pan-Africanism, and the desire to find appropriate ways in which to organize the scientific, realistic, and contemporary study and promotion of the history of Pan-Africanist thought. However, to be honest, I personally believe that despite this strong emotional and historical importance, these celebrations are also taking place in an environment plagued by concerns about the future. These concerns need to be analyzed, clarified, and overcome. I believe that Pan-Africanist thought and ideals are compelling elements of modern African history, of Africa and its diaspora. In their very essence, they inspired a desire for self-determination, which perseveringly fought for the cultural rehabilitation and the restoration of the dignity of African slaves and their descendants in the Americas, as well as the cultural regeneration and the enhancement of dignity of colonized Africans in Africa. Thus, the main protagonists caused and led a convergence in history between the aspirations and the goals of equality, the enjoyment and the full realization of civil and political rights for African Americans, the aspiration of African peoples to self-determination and independence, and the political resolution of degrading relations which were imposed by colonial dependency. This convergence can only be explained by the existence and preservation of memories and by a sense of belonging, common human origin, by the awareness that both peoples were living in similar situations of denial of their fundamental human rights, by their shared understanding of the unique nature of the discrimination, suffering, and humiliations that were imposed on the two transatlantic communities, by the perception that their goal was to build a common future based on solidarity, and finally, the awareness that success required a strategy of solidarity and unity among the leaders driving the two liberation struggles. Following the resistance, revolts, and struggles, wherein we must include the American Civil War, which resulted in the abolition of slavery in the Americas, a constellation of Pan-Africanist thinkers flourished in the African-American communities towards the late 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. William Du Bois, George Padwell, Dudley Thompson, and Marcus Garvey stand out among other well-known intellectuals. I wonder what influence the Haitian Revolution had on them. Incidentally, it was the intellectual Afro-Haitian Antonin Firmin who, in 1885, unequivocally refuted Arthur Gobineau's theories of racial superiority by responding to them with scientifically founded arguments. At the same time in history, colonialism was thriving in all its splendor on the African continent, conquering and subjugating its peoples and destroying still fragile local state institutions. For the people in Africa, this was a time of resistance to colonial infiltration and the establishment of colonial rule in its various forms on the continent, culminating in the loss of national sovereignty and the establishment of colonial oppressive regimes in Africa. It was in the intellectual camp, in opposition to the darkness of colonialism, subjugation, and racial discrimination, that the ideals of Pan-Africanist cultural resistance and black consciousness emerged. Both these ideals sustained oppressed Africans' aspirations of social and cultural emancipation. And to this camp, we need to add the earlier contributions made by James Africanus Horton from 1835 to 1883 in Sierra Leone and the Gold Coast, as well as those of Edward Wilmot Blyden in Liberia, and finally Emperor Menelik II in Ethiopia. However, it was under the leadership of Kwame Nkrumah in 1945 that the Pan-Africanist movement underwent its genuine political upgrade and embraced the ideal of the people's liberation struggle and the fight for independence from the European colonizers in Africa and the Caribbean. This brief historical overview has simply allowed me to place Pan-Africanist ideals and their contribution within the purview of the political process that led to the independence of African states and to the later establishment of the OAU. The majority of African independence parties promoted the idea of the elimination of colonialist imposed borders and integration of their respective peoples. Furthermore, many of the liberations were multinational and promoted the creation of a federation of African states. Moreover, national liberation struggles took place interdependently within an environment of strong cooperation and solidarity among the freedom fighters and their respective political organizations. Conversely, though, the processes that led to independence occurred in a piecemeal fashion, colony by colony and state by state. Even some of the more federal entities that existed at the time did not survive. So, unitary and federalist intentions did not materialize. In 1963, at the time when the Organization of African Unity was founded by 32 sovereign African states, I was a militant in the PAIGC party, the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. It was a party which was involved in an armed struggle for the independence of the then Portuguese colonies of Cape Verde and Guinea-Bissau. We followed the debates regarding which union model should be chosen with great passion and hope. At that stage, the revolutionary proposals of the Casablanca group were juxtaposed to the more moderate and conservative proposals of the Monrovia group. Finally, the model that was found, the so-called Africa of States, was a compromised solution. Thus, the Organization of African Unity was founded, and Kwame Nkrumah's Pan-Africanist and Federalist plan was placed on hold. It is not my intention to offer an assessment of the OAU's performance. I would rather try to offer an assessment of its usefulness. I'll focus on the practical usefulness of having an institution that could assert Africa's independence, especially with regard to the pursuance of national struggles for liberation and self-determination in the colonies. We need to do justice to the important role that the Organization of African Union played and to the usefulness it displayed in bringing colonialism to an end in Africa. Indeed, it managed to mobilize the governments of independent African states to help in the complete eradication of colonialism on the African continent. Furthermore, it also mobilized itself to put an end to the apartheid regime in South Africa. Certainly, today, colonialism and apartheid are simply themes that can be relegated to the annals of history. But we must not forget that the struggles and processes that led to their eradication deserve the attention of African historians and scholars and should be studied at research and documentation centers dedicated to the documentation and preservation of the memories of all precursors and protagonists, so that Africa's true history can be written impartially without misrepresentations nor ideological biases. I am well aware of the political and material value of the OAU's contribution, as well as of its failures, because I was also a leader of an armed liberation movement. However, African diplomacy and the subsequent diplomatic alliances were decisive in the struggle against and the isolation of the last bastions of colonialism on the African continent, as well as in the national armed liberation struggles in the former Portuguese colonies, which brought independent Africa to the very borders of the apartheid regime. This significant step forward brought on a strategic shift in the relations between the forces of domination and regression on the one hand, and the forces of liberation and progress on the other, which the apartheid government did everything to counter and delay, resorting to spurious and failed alliances, aggression, wars, and sabotage. The political, military, and diplomatic gains that were made engendered an international environment as well as military and political power relations that became favorable to the armed struggle of South Africans bent on overthrowing the apartheid regime. Thus it was that we finally witnessed the complete liberation of the African continent from the yoke of colonial domination and the regressive apartheid regime. In those circumstances, the OAU's Liberation Committee served as a valuable instrument that provided African solidarity and political, material, and military support to the continuing national liberation struggles and their final victories. The OAU's Liberation Committee was a clear manifestation of the commitment by sovereign African states to the total liberation of Africa's people. However, by this, I do not mean to ignore the fact that there were vacillations, hesitations, and even complicity on the part of some African states. Indeed, great conviction and determination were required for the political liberation process to be seen through to its glorious end. Certainly, the process of liberation of Africa's people would have been more complicated and longer had it not been for the active solidarity between sovereign African states and the national liberation movements, which brought on its heels the solidarity of anti-colonial and progressive forces from all over the world. And of course, we cannot forget and must emphasize the issue of solidarity among African peoples themselves. Thank you. As with everything, freedom has its costs, and Africans and their states bore these costs. I would like to emphasize a point that I consider essential for the correct understanding of modern African history. The African people's struggle for self-determination and independence must be understood primarily as their attempt to recover their historical initiative. Indeed, colonial domination meant that African people lost their right to write their own history and became bound and tied up in their rulers' initiatives and thereby their rulers' history. By taking on a struggle for their own liberation, a change came over them, and Africans once again took ownership of their historical initiatives and of their own right to be the protagonists and subjects of their own history. Consequently, the struggles for independence became victories that resulted from their taking ownership of their own historical initiatives. I believe that it is this emancipating historical initiative that needs to be revived and pursued today. I would like to put the Organization of African Unity and its contribution aside for a moment and highlight another aspect of modern African history which I consider important, and that is the nation-building processes in sovereign African states and the building of their respective institutions. I am of the opinion that the colonial regimes applied the logic of colonial administrative violence, which purposely ignored the cultures, institutions, and traditions of the societies they dominated and on which they imposed colonial order and logic. The new independent African governments inherited and pursued this colonial administrative culture, which meant that indigenous socio-cultural realities were ignored and serious distortions and anomalies manifested in the design and building of sovereign state institutions. The result was weak state institutions which still plague Africa today. In my opinion, the problem of the so-called post-independent African crisis can, in the majority of cases, be traced back to institutional crisis caused by generally weak, unrepresentative, and dysfunctional state institutions. Thus, in our search for ways in which to overcome institutional crises and promote socioeconomic development, I believe that the key is to focus on establishing the rule of law and all the institutions associated with it so that viable political alternatives can be found. I believe that it's not enough to condemn the mistakes and abuses that were committed and possibly even the crimes. And please understand that I am in no way advocating impunity. However, I believe that it is necessary to seek to understand the underlying issues and their respective causes, to seek to understand the complexity of societies, and to understand how complex the process of nation building has been for the new independent states, rather than thinking that it is easy to establish new, effective, and legitimate political institutions through some mechanical method of copy and paste. And in the middle of all this, there is another issue that I consider crucial, and that is the capacity of African states to transform their inherited institutional culture and to replace it with something more creative. In this regard, an institutional culture that is more creative and responsive to the new social realities on the continent is a prerequisite for the building of the desired state institutions. There is another issue that requires attention, but it is of a more ethical nature. How do we ensure that merit, competence, dedication, and professionalism become fundamental criteria for our public service and for the proper management of our country's and continent's rex publicae? Returning to the Organization of African Unity, I would like to point out only two shortcomings from my perspective. Firstly, I know that studies and ambitious plans were formulated. However, little attention was paid to the strategies and material and human resources that were required for bringing those ambitions to fruition. Neither was sufficient attention paid to defining feasible priorities that could generate new resources and opportunities. Thus, the decisions that were made became mere intentions. Secondly, we ignored or underestimated the fundamental issue of the need to build up recently established states so that these could function as legitimate, efficient, representative sovereign states with solid institutions. The organization and quality of the states was not a top political priority. The same fundamental issue, that is the nature and quality of African states, plagues the African Union today. I would like to place the issue of the quality of states at the epicenter of the debate on our African future. It is my firm belief that the unification of African states would be more easily attained if all our African states were more strategic, efficient, legitimate, and robust, so that they could support and foster stability and predictability on the continent, the prerequisites for sustainable social, economic, cultural, and institutional development. I would also suggest the adoption of an updated version of Pan-Africanism. Indeed, contemporary Pan-Africanism, which would include a search for answers to current questions. It is certain that we are in a position to evaluate the Pan-Africanism that was practiced during these 50 years and to identify its gains as well as its weaknesses. I ask myself if its implementation was innovative and sufficiently integrating and manifesting sufficient solidarity. Did it maintain its emancipating nature? Did it dignify the societies on the African continent? Did it ensure solidarity amongst the states? And was that solidarity sufficient and efficient? These are some of the questions that I ask myself. With regard to this Pan-Africanist vision, many times we have seen different discursive, subjective, and cultural discussions without solid foundation among African leaders who are totally withdrawn from the political plans that would ensure gradual construction of these states and ensure a more unitary architecture. These are the attitudes and proposals which we believe could substitute the ambitious agenda, political agenda, and ensure that it would become far more realist and practical. And in this perspective, the first commitment should be to ensure that Pan-Africanist ideals could be translated into something that would reaffirm our commitment to the areas of politics and the edification of institutions as well as economic development. I would also suggest the adoption of an updated version of Pan-Africanism, which would include a search for answers to current questions, doubts, and concerns, as well as clear explanations by all the critics of Pan-Africanism of their attitudes and positions. I would also demand loyalty and commitment from all leading politicians to the implementation of Pan-Africanist ideal and its goals of African emancipation. Another question that begs an answer is, what would be the place and role of political parties in the debate and in the implementation of the contemporary Pan-Africanist ideal? In this theoretical and ideological reconstruction process, the universities and African think tanks would have an essential role to play. Another principle, the third one, would be to recognize contemporary Pan-Africanism's liberating nature, since it is based on a vision of the world that begins with Africa and strategic African interests. It would, I suppose, be a rather large and audacious political ambition to have an Afro-centered view of the future and the world. Ultimately, the goal of our struggle is a relentless pursuit for the future. But what future? It is not a future where we are all just subjects and subordinates to the decisions and desires of others. Rather, we aspire to a future in which we are also the protagonists, a future in which we too have a say and a place in the sun in global fora, a future that makes us stronger, freer, more qualified, prosperous, just and brotherly, in a fairer, safer, more balanced, peaceful, and more predictable world. Current Afro-optimism is a sign of the times, which is taking the former Afro-pessimists by surprise. In my view, our Afro-optimism is based on proven results, on the sum of small changes, small gains, small successes, which the Afro-pessimists didn't know how to uncover, perhaps because they were impatient, because of the impatient perfectionism that demanded resounding and perfect results, or perhaps because they had difficulty in understanding and assessing the complexity of the historical African process that was taking place before their very eyes. Meanwhile, they underestimated African efforts and capacities, and their harsh criticism distorted the truth about the real transformation process that has been taking place on African soil. Likewise, we cannot ignore the contest that is going on at global level, engendered by the current economic situation, which has led to the assertion of emerging economies. With regard to this new Afro-optimism, my attitude is one of moderate and careful optimism. I believe that it is essential that leaders remain vigilant and humble and engage in a policy that is cautious, frugal, and focused on sustained growth, supported by national and continental structural transformation and modernization agenda for all spheres of socioeconomic and financial thought and activity. However, not all is bright and favorable. There are persistent poles of armed conflict and institutional instability on the continent. The old risks remain, and new risks have emerged. My attention has been drawn to the critical importance of security and stability in the vast territories of Sahara and Sahel countries, which stretch from the Atlantic to the Red Sea. These dangers are embodied mainly by messianic and Islamic religious extremist armed movements, the countering and combating of which is extremely complicated, precisely due to their messianic and religious natures. I know that I'm touching on an extremely uncomfortable and sensitive issue, but the truth of the matter compels us to face the facts and not hide our heads in the sand like the proverbial ostrich. I am well aware that I am running the risk of being misunderstood, but I think that a clear, lucid, and sincere investigation of the nature of this extremism, its propagation centers, and funding should be carried out. Furthermore, I believe that the success of the political and military actions of the African Union forces in Somalia is evidence that this fight and its victory are possible. However, it is very important and urgent that the international community understands that this is a complex process which requires time and patience, and that it contributes in a committed and effective manner to the building of a lasting solution. Another serious threat to our continent is the drug trafficking that has been eroding the foundations of some of our sovereign African states. Once again, the fight against this evil requires an integrated approach and a more widespread and transcontinental international alliance in order to ensure lasting success, as well as the restoration of the institutions of these threatened states. Finally, I hold the belief that in the current global context, African leaders are being called upon to bring forth their own vision of globalization, one which supports the fostering of economic integration and the implementation of public policies that will reduce the various forms of dependency. The diversification of foreign partnerships and the search for alternative markets to the traditional ones. The promotion of sound, credible, and dynamic financial systems that can respond to current development challenges. It is equally imperative to invest in the training of our human resources in order to improve their productivity and to make our national economies more globally competitive. I also believe that it is imperative to overcome the weaknesses in our African societies. In order to face and overcome current African challenges, I would like to suggest some strategic objectives and mechanisms that I believe are relevant, such as the creation of strategist, effective, and inclusive states, the improvement of the quality and efficiency of our national sovereign states, the promotion of the reformation and modernization of our societies in order to overcome social inertia caused by prevailing conservative traditional values, and the development of our human resources as a top priority through education and training. The promotion and prioritization of an institutional and democratic culture, as well as the encouragement of public participation. The improvement of the quality and capacity of our universities and research institutes, supported by relevant public research policy. The fostering and retention of scientific, technological, and research skills in our respective countries, and the prevention of the brain drain phenomenon. The overcoming of our technological, energy, and computer challenges, and the harnessing of our huge potential. The harnessing of our huge potential in alternative energy and hydraulic resources. The expansion and modernization of our infrastructures, our means of telecommunications and communication by air, land, and sea. The promotion, expansion, and upgrading of our industrial and agro-industrial resources. The strengthening of our banking and financial systems, the modernization of our agriculture, currently marked by traditional low productivity techniques, the training of our farmers, and the expansion of irrigated agriculture with the ultimate goal of ensuring effective food security. As individual countries, the protection of our continental and national land, material, and natural heritages, and the capacity building of our political, economic, and social leadership. The objectives that I have mentioned above would be part of a long-term strategy and African agenda aimed at building a peaceful, united, strong, and prosperous Africa, positioned in a peaceful, prosperous, just, and predictable world. I am well aware that this scenario could contain some hints of utopia. Finally, by way of clarification, I would just like to mention that I have not presented you a thesis or a research study. I have simply presented some of my memories and experiences. Thank you.
Mr. President, thank you very much for an insightful and inspiring lecture. I think all of us here and at home, we have learned so much. It might not have been a thesis or a research paper, but it's a reflection from somebody who has had a vast experience on what are the challenges and what can be the solutions. From your input, particularly on the suggestions you made, I was heartened that indeed it affirms the correctness of the economic program that was adopted by the African Union, NEPAD. I think various elements that you mentioned are what is contained in that document. And the challenge is, what will we do, not just as African governments and states, but as African citizens? You touched an important part on building of the human resource capacity. And I think all of us here, in our various capacities, there's something that we ought to do. As a lecturer, it now remains for us to find ways in which we can continue this dialogue in our various entities and spaces where we are. I would like to thank you as a disciplined audience, because in a lecture, there are no questions. And we had promised each other by accepting to come here that the lecture will end at 8:30. And my watch says we have just missed that by 5 minutes. So I will now invite the head of the Thabo Mbeki African Leadership Institute, Professor Vusi Gumede, to come and give a vote of thanks. Vusi.
Thanks, Program Director, Sis Toko. She's affectionately known to us as Sis Toko. That's how we call her, and I will call her that this way. As I give a vote of thanks, please, the headsets need to go back, so people must make sure that they don't leave with those headsets. It's important that we make that note. I observe protocol. I won't be able to go through in the interest of time of all the protocol. And there's not much more to say, really. Among other things, as Sis Togo said, we've just gone through a very comprehensive exposition of our history as Africans, and I think the marching orders are very clear that we must write, and I use write figuratively here, and I use write in a symbolic sense, that we have to write and rewrite our African history as well as author our future. And for our students at the Thabo Mbeki African Leadership Institute, as well as our teachers in the institute, President Pires has given us a very comprehensive body of thought to ponder, to unpack, to problematize, to act upon, of which we must do. And we have a lot to digest and grapple with as we embark on another long journey in the further advancement of our continent. Indeed, Africa continues to rise. I start by thanking our keynote speaker, President Pires. Thank you very much. I had a very good discussion with President Pires yesterday evening. He was exhausted, had just arrived, but I was educated significantly in a very short space of time that we had some discussions with him yesterday. Secondly, of course, I need to thank our patron and the patron of the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, the patron of both the Thabo Mbeki Foundation as well as Thabo Mbeki African Leadership Institute, former President Mbeki. He continues to inspire all of us. Thirdly, I must thank our principal and vice chancellor, Professor Mandla Makhanya, and the executive management of the University of South Africa and the extended management of the university. And of course, our program director, Mrs. Toko Didiza. And thank you very much to the poet, Dr. Don Matera. That was moving. We all got very inspired. I thank our colleagues in the UNISA Corporate Communications and Marketing. I thank our colleagues at the UNISA Security. And I should thank our broadcasting partner, SAFM, and also thank UNISA Radio that has been streaming the lecture. We should thank the emergency services. They remain on standby. It was important to have them here. We must thank the Tswane municipality for the cooperation in the organizing of the lecture. Thanks to video recording colleagues and photographers. And most importantly, or amongst most important people, we must thank our people who are going to feed us, the catering services. And thanks also to Con Jacobs, who's always ready to assist, and thanks to the team as well. And also thanks to other members of the organizing team, including both from the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, as well as the Thabo Mbeki African Leadership Institute and other UNISA colleagues. We should thank the media that's in attendance. And lastly, and most importantly, you, our guest. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vusi. I may not have given you an opportunity to ask questions, but I have given you a gift. In the bags that you have, maybe some of you only took the program. There is a commemorative book of the OAU at 50, which was done by the Thabo Mbeki Foundation. It contains very important papers by some of our scholars, which I think you will enjoy. So beyond the lecture, there's a lot of study that we still have to do. Can we give ourselves a round of applause for being such a good audience? We will now, as we come to the end of this program, make some few announcements. Having had food for thought, we need to have food for the stomach. President Pires mentioned the importance of food security. and I'm starting to implement that now. For those of you who have got tags that have got VIP and dignitary, you would go to Philadelphia restaurant, which is up the stairs. They would lead you our ushers. For all of us who are VVVIPs, we will have our refreshments in a lovely marquee. I'm sure all of us, as we came through, we saw it. As we go out the hall, down the stairs, Theo van Wyk, we turn left towards the parking lot that is called Goldfield. That's where there are two marquees, where the Thabo Mbeki Foundation and UNISA say you can enjoy, continue to network. This night is still young. It's Friday. It's the end of the month. We have made sure that those of you who got your paychecks today are going to be safe. You are not going to use them. At least it's on us today. Thank you very much, and good night. Terra de paz, terra de gozo. Tudo que eu me passei de gozo. Ele catava e ele queria ficar. Mas ele manda tentar chorar. Oi, Cabo Verde, terra estimada.